Join us as we gather around the hedge, where we dig into technology, business, and culture with the finest minds in computer networking.
Well, hello, Tom. How are you today?
Hi, Russ. I'm doing fantastic. How about you?
I'm fine. My audio seems a little low, but you know, maybe it's just me. I don't know. The other day I had this and I had to unplug my USB port and replug it back in because there was something with the USB driver that was freaky. But I don't know. We'll run with it and see where it goes. And everything looks identical in your office.
Yep. It's a, I'm going to call it an immutable office.
An immutable office.
There we go.
Okay.
Immutable office.
It's ASA. Philosophically, it's ASA. It's unable to change because it is self-existing.
See, I'm jealous of Tom because there's a ton of sunshine. If it's immutable, I'm moving there, you know?
Yeah, I do like, I mean, my office has no windows. In fact, there are no windows on this entire floor, pretty much.
Oh my God.
It's nice. A basement. And I really have like one or two windows and they're in the shop. And so you have to open the door between the shop and the rest of the house to get any fresh air down here. So it's a little stuffy sometimes down here and stuff like that. But I don't know. It's okay. I've been moving my office around. I've been playing with lights and all sorts of stuff and trying to figure out better ways of doing things. I am a over-optimization dude. I over-optimize everything. And, you know, that's just my life. So today we have with us Eric Chow. Eric joined us, I don't know, a month or two ago to talk about publishing. We'll talk about the same thing again today. But you know, Eric, I'm just going to point this out. We do hedge episodes on other things than publishing. And you're always welcome to come back and talk to us about other stuff. I mean, you know, you don't just...
I mean, thanks for the invite. But I've heard the hedge, you know, podcast multiple times. I'm just not... on par with the normally esteemed guests.
That's ridiculous.
So I'm happy being a listener, just observing all the wisdoms of your guests.
That's crazy. Now, that's the imposter syndrome right there now.
Oh, yeah. I actually posted a link on, so maybe some of the listeners know that I recently switched jobs and going from, you know, A10 to Network to Code. As part of the onboarding process, and rightfully so, that whenever there's a new change, especially a large change, like, you know, changing jobs, you often feel like an imposter. So as part of the onboarding process, this is the first time after going through multiple companies, right, like Microsoft and Amazon and all these other companies, that the first time that in the onboarding session that they actually have a talk on how to avoid the imposter syndrome. So I thought that was really neat. And I put a link on all the resources I saw, the Imposter Cure and the book and some of the NANOG presentation by Matt. And it got a lot of impressions. So apparently I'm not the only one.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, there's a whole podcast on it, the imposter syndrome, right? Yeah.
That was part of the link that I included as well by Chris. Cool. Chris and Zoe.
Yeah. Yeah. As a matter of fact, when I first started at Cisco, my first day at Cisco on the hardware team, I walked in the door. They gave me a badge. They took me to the badging office. I got my badge. I walked up to the hardware team where the hardware team was sitting. And Renee Daltrey pointed at a cubicle and said, "That's your cubicle. That's your phone. Answer it." And that was the whole thing. That was my whole...
That was your onboarding
process. Yeah. He said, "Now I know you don't have documentation right now. We'll get you some documentation. We have some on order. We'll find you some documentation. But in the meantime, just answer the phone." And I'm like, "Dude,
what do I say when I answer the phone?"
I said, "Hello." Like, what? I don't know what to do with that.
Thank you for calling Cisco. What can I do for you?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Man, that was just crazy. That was a crazy environment. TAC was crazy. TAC was just insane. I could tell you TAC story after TAC story, all the stuff that we did and stuff. People throwing chairs across the cubicle walls and throwing water at each other and using water guns and Nerf guns. And oh my goodness, that was such a high-stress, crazy environment. But anyway. Okay, so today we are talking about publishing again. So Let's just start with, we talked about tools a little bit last time. We talked about writing books a little bit last time. We talked about publishers, whether or not you should publish or self-publish or whatever the last time, which, by the way, I just ran into a story about this. I'm doing some new work with Pearson, as always, because that's who I ever work with most of the time. And I have a co-author, which is something we should talk about, is co-authoring a little bit. And this is a video series. And he went into the onboarding for Pearson because he's never worked with them before. And they said, and we're going to give you a link so that you can share the training you're doing with your social media people. And he's like, don't you do any promotion? Don't you share it? And they're like, not really. Nice. And he was totally amazed by that. And I'm like, oh, welcome to the world of publishing.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. So I think we briefly talked about it last time, and this is a good segue, that a lot of times the I don't want to say burden, but the work for marketing and for promotion relies on the author. And I think that's it's good and bad, because the author get to expand their own reach and, you know, help you if you ever do a second book, if you do video content like you and Tom, then, you know, those are the crossovers. But at the same time, you do need to, it is a new skill set. It's different from writing a book, for sure. So you do need to be your own best advocate.
Yeah. Well, if you do the marketing, you own your audience.
Correct.
And so the downside of you doing your marketing is you don't have the reach. And you probably never will have the reach of a publisher. Honestly, you just won't. Or a marketing department for a big vendor, whoever it is. You're just not never going to have the reach of a corporation for the most part.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to do SEOs, right? Like, and you're not going to know which keyword to bid. And I mean, it's only a subset of people who ever goes on Google Trends and just look at what are the trendings and all of that. That's for sure. I mean, you're just never gonna have, you're gonna have to find a pretty niche to establish your authority, go on and you two have done.
Yeah. And then, but then once you have an audience, it's your audience. It's not the company's audience, right? So this is, I'll give you a perfect example. This is a difference between Facebook or YouTube and Substack. Substack does not own your audience. YouTube owns your audience. You can think all you want to that you own your audience on YouTube. You don't. They do. Like X or Twitter is kind of in the middle of that, in between those two things. And this is part of choosing where you're going to publish to me, who you're going to publish with or how. Because like, if I'm going to go to Twitter and try to build a show on Twitter specifically, then I have to be pretty confident I'm going to have a large enough audience to make money off of advertising alone, because that's all you get, really, except tip jar, pretty much. Whereas if I'm going to go on Substack, I have to be confident that I'm going to at least pull 1,000 people in who are going to eventually pay to subscribe. And it doesn't have to be a lot of money in each subscription, but it's still enough to keep you going and to keep you making some money off of it. So Substack is better for niches, and Twitter is just going to be better for highly popular stuff that's applicable to everybody. There's no right or wrong to that. It's just like, you just have to think through, what are you trying to get done? What is the goal? What am I trying to do here? And, so what and how about, patient am I?
What about, I'm curious about what you said about YouTube. So what is the difference between that and Substack? Is it that YouTube, it's more of their content kind of blended with yours? Or how is it that you own your audience more on Substack versus YouTube?
So on YouTube, they can take your audience away. They can demonetize you. The only money you make on YouTube is through advertising. Now, there are tip jars, again, stuff like that. And people can subscribe to your content. But their algorithm still drives what goes to the users, not who subscribes to you. I can go to YouTube and subscribe all day long to 5 different people or 100 different people. The YouTube algorithm that gives their content preference in my inbox, but it's not guaranteed I'm not going to get everything that they put out there. And the way they make their money is through advertising, product placement, sponsorships, blah, blah, blah. Substack, everything you write goes to all of your subscribers. 100%. No filters. And the other thing is, if you leave Substack, like Pirate Wires just did this, and I've been trying to get myself together to write for Pirate Wires a little bit, not that they would pay me, but just because I think it's a really cool platform. They just left Substack, and not for any reason like Substack is horrible or whatever. They left Substack because they felt like they were big enough that they could stand on their own and build their own website. There are some other technical reasons, but that's the primary reason. Now, on Substack, if you're an author, you can go to your author page and you can say, download my entire mailing list, paid and unpaid subscribers. Then you can, it downloads it in a format that you can then put into almost any mail package, and you can email that same set of subscribers. So you own your audience. You can take your audience with you when you leave Substack. And it's intentional on the part of Substack to do that, which is one thing I like about their business model.
Yeah, I think it's about distribution channel. So YouTube is, you know, both the distribution channel as well as the platform. Yes. So their algorithm actually controls a lot of the content that the end user sees. So for example, I'm a fan of this particular individual. I subscribe to his channel. I watch every single video, but one of his video was labeled for inappropriate for children or whatnot, or inappropriate for general public. Then mistakenly, but I will not see that video ever unless I go seek out that, as opposed to Substack, where you have, they're just a distribution channel and they provide the tools for you to reach your audience. It's no different than building your own email list, except they take the payment part. And I think that was, correct me if I'm wrong, Russ, but I think that was how Substack's original purpose, like their mission statement, was to enable the creators to reach their audience directly. And they actually reach out to a bunch of, I believe it was New York Times author, like the sports columnists, and all these people who already have a following, and say, why do you take a salary from New York Times and they own your distribution channel? Because they don't know who subscribed to it. They don't know who reads their emails or reads their columns. Why don't you take that? You abstract that out of your newspaper, substitute that with YouTube or any other platforms, and own your own audience, even though it's a subset of it, but you extract more value out of it, you could sustain your platform.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And now they do video. So I do write on Substack, but I don't write on technology on Substack. I have a thing called Dispatches from Ziklag, which is about theology and culture and stuff like that. I am starting, potentially, I'm trying to start, it is taking me a lot longer than I thought, a paid subscription service on rule11.tech around tech training.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like with tech training, I can get away with starting on my own platform. I don't need to go to something like Substack, right? Whereas the other stuff is more like on the side, maybe this will do something, maybe it won't. Why should I bother supporting my own platform, building a website, doing everything else? And Substack does do some promotion a little bit, like, they will have a front page. If you go to Substack.com or if you are a subscriber for one Substack, they will promote other Substacks that are similar to that one. So you do get a little bit. It's not a ton of promotion. And as an author, you can promote other Substacks that you enjoy or you subscribe to or partner with on your Substack. So there's a bit more community than just having your own website with Substack. So, I always say you should blog. Everyone should blog, but I actually would extend that to things like Twitter, LinkedIn, depending on what you're trying to do. If you're not trying to bring revenue in from your writing, there is nothing wrong with doing all of your writing on LinkedIn or on Twitter in long form, short form video, whatever it is. There's nothing wrong with using another platform if your goal is not to make revenue off of it. If the goal is just to be yourself.
Yeah, I'm wondering what, you know, Tom's thoughts on this as well. But, you know, to me, you know, it's kind of like a funnel, just like everybody talk about your marketing funnel. Mm-hmm. So at the top of the funnel could be all of your social, wherever you publish, periodically, consistently, and you grab that funnel. As you go through the funnel, you're expected to have smaller and smaller audience, but you lead them towards something that is is paid behind a paywall, a subscription, whatnot, so you could sustain it. But so the key is actually to make the overhead and the cost of distribution at the top of that funnel as thin as possible. And that is where the social media platform comes in, whether that's Twitter and YouTube and or whatnot. And I'm wondering what your thoughts about that is, Tom.
Yeah, I mean, so our model on the hedge, we're non-commercial. We don't have we're not trying to make money here. So a lot of the you know, there's a lot of constraints we don't really have to deal with,
right?
And so there still is overhead, of course, a little bit, but it's you know, it's not really that big. And I don't know, it feels to me more like a service to the community. It feels more like a gathering place to talk about these topics. And you know, hopefully we can send people off to other content that they would like too. I mean, a lot of the people that we interview, like yourself, are content creators, and they have great stuff they want to share. And so, yeah, I don't know. It seems more of a community building thing that we do here more than anything else.
Yeah, I guess we should you know, kind of qualify the end goal is like you get your reward from servicing the community, right? And that in itself is equivalent to whatever X dollars that you put on top of that. And to me, that's very noble, and that's great.
Yeah. Well, there is a financial return even for something that's non-commercial like this, which is just visibility, right?
Right.
And like, if Tom goes to get a new job someday, somebody's going to go, "Oh, he's the co-host of The Hedge. We know what he knows," right? There's nothing wrong with that, honestly. I think in the publishing world, we often get trapped in, can I make a lot of money?
Right.
Or can I do the best thing for the community possible? And honestly, it's not an either or thing.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, to me, I mean, you know this, you know, as well as I do, that you're not going to get a lot of money from working for a publisher anyways. And even if you self-publish, you don't have the distribution channel. So your addressable, kind of your base, it just shrunk by default. So, but at the same time, I do feel that, you know, it's not so much about the money, but rather a benchmark of the value you're providing to people. You know, if it's completely free, that's a very different model than if you just ask somebody to pay 99 cents. It's not about the money, but rather it's how much skin they have in the game.
Yeah. Well, and that's another thing I've talked about with people often is that, like, I charge for dispatches from Ziklag. Why do I? I mean, I'm not a big voice in that community. But the thing is, people also often feel like they're not getting value if they're not paying.
Right.
It's right. You get what you pay for. If you're not paying for it, you're not getting anything. So, I think that's not true of The Hedge. I think people realize the value of The Hedge, even though we don't charge for it. But I think in many cases, people will not download a book on networking because it's free. Right? They would rather go buy a book because they feel like if it's been purchased, then it's been edited, it's been taken care of. Somebody, it's professional. Whereas if they just go download it off the internet, it's kind of like, whatever. You know, nobody really cares about this. They just kind of threw it out there.
Well, yeah, you're talking. Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead, Tom.
Collision. That brings up the notion of format. And by format, I don't just mean like podcast versus book versus blog, but like even inside of whatever delivery vehicle you're using, there are lots of opportunities to use format to accomplish what you're trying to do. So for example, for this podcast there are no advertising slots, but also it's just a conversation. I think personally, some of the best content out there is when engineers just get together and shoot the breeze and talk about what they want to talk. We've had some amazing conversations on The Hedge and in other formats that just some of those conversations we wouldn't have had in other formats. And so I think format is a big part of the puzzle too.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, you just got to meet the audience where they are. If they do prefer a audio format, if they prefer, you know, kind of a word format, or just how they learn, how they consume content. And I do think the playing field is very level nowadays. It used to be that for video distribution, you have limited distributors and therefore they're gated by that. But now I can't think of any format that is still being gated by the middleman between, you know, content creators and the audience. What do you think, Ross?
I don't think there's anything. I mean, like Substack started adding video to their stuff now. Now, what I find interesting about that, though, is another piece of understanding your audience is I cut against the grain. I prefer written. I don't think I cut against the grain in the networking community. I think most people in the networking community actually prefer written over video if they're experienced. Now, at the lower junior levels, I think people do prefer video. But I think as you grow in your career, people tend to prefer written material. It's faster. It's denser. As an example, many years ago, I wrote a book on ISIS. And then many years later, I said, I'd like to do a second edition of that. There have been changes to the protocol. There are some things I would change. And Pearson said, why don't you do a video instead? So I did a video series. And they said, try to shoot up for about 6 hours of content. I could only cover about a third of that book in 6 hours of video. Literally, just I had to keep ripping stuff out of the outline. Text is just so much denser than video is in many ways. Now, if you're showing somebody, choose this menu option, do that, click on this, yeah, video is a lot better because you're actually seeing something happen and you're actually able to you don't have to mentally visualize it, you see it. But for technology stuff, I still think that, so you have to know your audience in this realm as well. You have to be very conscious of who you're going after and what you're saying.
What do you think, Tom? I'm interested in hearing your opinion as well, because I know you consume a ton of books. I could see from your background or your bookshelf.
No, he didn't mean any of
those. Oh, no, he went there.
I do consume a lot of books. Immutable office space. You know? So if you take a book out, that means it's not immutable anymore, right? But right. Anyways, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Sorry, I'm catching up still. So I think the idea about text versus video, I think that's really, really interesting. And I think that it has taken a while for content creators to sort of figure that out. I think people went to a format that they thought was popular. And the other thing is, which is fine. I mean, you want wide distribution of your stuff. That's great. But knowing your audience I think you have an opportunity to make a lot bigger impact, however you define impact by understanding how your audience is going to consume, how your audience wants to and most effectively consumes your things. You can influence things a lot more if you understand that. If you are, for example, in networking, if you really, really want to get ideas into the junior network engineers, video is the way. That's just how they started learning. That's how it makes sense to them. But if you want to communicate and put ideas into more senior people, then it needs to be efficient. They need to be able to scan it like a man page or like a documentation page. And if you write it that way, your influence will be felt. And so it depends on what you're trying to impact. And I think it's worth thinking about.
Yeah. And I think that was exactly what we talked about before we hit the record button before the show, right? You're cross-pollinating between media. So back to your example, Ross, I think if you go back to, Pearson and said, yes, I could overshoot it, right? I could write a second edition that is the text dense format, but I'll abstract, 6 hours or less of it for the people who prefer video format. So then you kind of meet your audience both ways and you kind of cross-pollinate your media contents.
But in that example, though, I mean, would Pearson have even been willing to publish the book if you said, I'll do both. I want to do both. Would they have published it?
No, because they look at the market and they know what makes money for them. And that's right. And that's neither, it's not saying they're wrong. It's saying they have to, they don't do a lot of other stuff, but they do invest in the editing process. They do. And they do have people who have to do accounting. They do have people who do all the other bits and pieces. And so there has to be a certain number of sales of a book for them to make. It's like if you're a router vendor, you don't want to make 10% on your routers. You want to make 80%, right? And somebody might come to you and say, well, I can sell this box and I'll make 10% off of it and I'll just sell a lot of them. Well, you better sell a lot of them because you're not making enough at 10% to stay in business. I mean, that's not what anybody cares about. So unfortunately, that's the way the world works now. Now, if you self-publish, frankly, I don't really care because I have no overhead. Other than my time, I have no overhead. Now, that comes down to time value of money. am I better off writing a book or going out and cutting the grass? Right? Because honestly, it costs me money to, if I don't cut the grass, if I spend the time writing a book instead. I mean, even in personal life, there's a cost trade-off. And so it does come down to that a lot of times. Is there a cost trade-off?
Yeah, and I think that's back to what we're talking about on the Substack, right? So, you know, you don't have that overhead. You don't have the full-time staff that Pearson does. So if you were able to, you know, I did the calculation about self-publishing, which ended up being wrong anyways, but but had I been able to do the self, because I did, you know, as we mentioned last time, I did self-publish the book, a book on Kafka, and I published the book on Mastering Python Networking. But if I were able to sell about 30% of what I sell on Mastering Python Networking with the Kafka book, because I was getting 80% of the revenue, I will be able to receive about the same amount. So back to what your previous example about Kafka, and I would lump in, you know, kind of the Vimeos and the videos of that world, that if you were able to do that, then I think you will be able to sustain those effort by just extracting more value, keeping more value for yourself.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Eric, have you found times when you made choices like what you just mentioned? Well, if I do this method, then I get this much. Have you ever made decisions based on, well, I want my time to be in this area, so I'm going to pull back on this and this because this is like, how have you done that sort of thing in your work?
All the time. I think for me now, because of maybe it's the same thing for Russ as well. For me, self-publishing was a checkbox, an additional feather on the hat. So every single edition, I would find like a new motivation. So the first book would be, you know, publish the first book. And the second book would be, can I do it again? And the third book would be, oh, you know, now I get to have, I know this is, you know, vanity, but I get to have my face on the cover, right? And then I'll multi-publish and so on and so forth. Yeah. So I'm running out of that kind of motivation nowadays. So my motivation now is actually to own my content and distribute it as freely as possible. Like during COVID, I would love to give my book for free for people who are unable to get these material otherwise. But I can't because it's gated by the publisher, and it's, you know, by contract, I cannot do that. So I would much rather do self-publishing nowadays. And I know maybe I'm in the minority, and when people talk to me, I might give a different answer based on, you know, who's talking to me. But if you ask me honestly right now, I much rather own my own content, even if the distribution is lower. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's actually the point I'm getting to as well, is that I'd rather own my own content, even if the distribution is lower. Yeah, and I think, like, when you talk about motivation, that's a big deal. You have to find your own motivation. Now, for me, it's become a matter of self-discipline. Mm. It's just something I do, right? There's just I have a certain amount of time every week I dedicate to creating content. Doesn't matter what that content is, I'm going to dedicate that amount of time to creating content every week. And so I think when you get to a point where you can get to that, then those little motivations of, you know, like the first book I published, yeah, I published it because, hey, this is really cool, right? Having my name on a book. Wow. Okay. But when you get to 15, you're kind of like, having your name on a book is like, yeah, whatever, right? Just move on with your life. But I think what motivates me now more is that I have a lot of things left to say that I think are very interesting. And I think that is, you know, would be very useful. I have different ways of saying it. I've discovered different ways of teaching this stuff or whatever that I think could be helpful. And so I think that's a motivation now, or addressing a different audience I've never addressed before type of thing. Those are motivators.
I wish I could say that by the time you get to 15, yeah. It's like, oh, yeah. There's a little, you know, muscle showing there by Russ.
No. Wow. but yeah. So another thing I think we should talk about is co-authoring. Because one thing that I have always told people is that if you want to get into the publishing game and you don't know how to start, first thing you do is just write. right? You can start a Substack. You can tell your friends. You can start a blog. Tell your friends, whatever. And maybe you'll make traction. Maybe you won't. But about 80% of anybody picking up a book and buying it is based on the name of the person, not the content of the book. And that's just a fact. I mean, this is, it's probably more so in the fiction market than it is in our market, than it is in the technology market. Maybe it's only 60% in the technology market. I know in the fiction market, the reason that people are doing things like so-and-so with Tom Clancy, so-and-so with so whatever they are, is because nobody buys a fiction book unless it has one of about 10 names on the cover. That's just the way things are now, which I think is sad, but it is what it is. So I always suggest to people that they co-author, that they approach a known author or an author that somebody they would like to work with, even if they're not a known author, by the way, because two people pushing on social media is always better than one. That's just the reality of the situation. And by the way, if you have two people on social media pushing on something, you can call yourselves something, and then it makes it sound even more official, like, you know, The Hedge or Network Collective, or, you know, you can make up a name, and then it becomes like a, ooh, that's an organization. It sounds really big. Wow, that's impressive, you know, kind of a thing.
But from now on, I'm just going to refer to myself as in third person. So Eric just said this, and Eric loves it.
That's right.
And make it more official.
Make it more official. So... But I've noticed recently that there are a lot of people I've been talking to who won't co-author, which I find very interesting. I don't know. I guess neither Tom nor Eric, have you approached anybody recently that said, just not it's not against you, I just don't co-author. Like, I find that interesting. That's it.
Yeah, I have some experience, but I'll let Tom speak first.
Well, I was just going to... Just to speculate a little bit, I would assume if they're an established author, they don't have anything to gain from that. And if they don't, you know, if their model is not to serve and to kind of reach down the ladder, then it wouldn't make any sense for them. There's not a reason.
So if that's the truth, I feel sad about it. Go ahead, Eric.
But back to what you were saying, and you know, in Hollywood, they say you get paid by your last film, right? So like you said, you a lot of people are established, but you know, with the big names and so on, so you actually have to kind of launch yourself somehow. And if that, you know, Sandra Bullock didn't get paid for, what is it, Speed? But, you know, she get paid for the next film because Speed was such a hit. So back to what you were talking about, seeking out established co-authors, I totally agree with that. It's just that my own personal experience is, you know, for the one book that I co-authored, I didn't really have a good time. Like, my style is just a little bit different than my co-author. And this is Rich Groves. Like, I've worked with him for now is like 14 years, and you know, we've been good friends, and you know, I reported to him before, so I have no problem getting along with Rich. But our writing style is different, our work style is different, and there's a little bit of a friction that when it comes to like meeting deadlines and you know, like getting X amount of stuff done. I know I. To your point, Russ, like I write pretty consistently. You know, we talked about Stephen King, like he always write about 6 pages and, you know, that consistency. So I subscribe to that philosophy, whereas maybe your co-author is a more of a inspirational, or, you know, like he would just write straight for 6 days and not sleep. But that's his style. So I think part of it of finding a co-author is also maybe the people you reach out to have a different style, have bad experience, or just knowing themselves that, you know, they might not work well with a co-author.
Yeah, that could be. Yeah, I'm just hearing it from a lot of people, from a lot of different people, and in not in the technology world so much, but in other worlds, I'm hearing it a lot. So I think that's interesting. So if you want a co-author, then the thing to do is to be persistent, number one. And number two, be flexible, not with the same person. Ask a lot of different people. Don't like beat them down one person's door.
Don't stalk them.
Yeah, don't stalk them or anything. But also be willing to be flexible. Like, work with the more experienced author's way of doing things, even if it's not your natural way of doing things. You know, people who've written a lot of books, they have a particular way that they do it. It's successful. It's like interning. It would be like being an intern or what's it called, with a plumber. Say you go out and you say to a plumber, I want to learn plumbing. And then the plumber takes you out on a job and says, go get this tool. Go, and you're like, no, go use that other tool. And he's like, dude, I've been doing plumbing for 20 years. Don't be telling me what tool to use for this job. Don't tell me what size hole to drill. I know what I'm doing. To some degree, if you're going to co-author somebody, you've got to be willing to work with their process. You've got to trust that their process is successful and adapt yourself to it. And that's just something you have to do. And a lot of people just aren't willing to do that work anymore. So I don't know what to say other than, you know.
I think the apprenticeship model has,
yeah.
I mean, it's a fairly old concept, and I think there's a lot of people for whom it's just not the way they think. There's a lot of people that they graduate from college or whatever, and then they're ready to go make their mark. And the idea that you would work underneath somebody else for a while just seems very, very foreign to a lot of people. But I think the apprenticeship model is perfect. This is how you gain, you know, your place in the world. You start there, and then after that, you go create your style. But I don't know. It seems intuitive to me, but that's kind of how I see it.
Yeah. Yep, definitely. So another thing we were talking about before the call was AI. And I'm just going to make a blanket statement. I try very hard not to rely on AI for anything. And I can understand its purposes in the promotional side, like we were talking about, Eric, before we started.
Yep.
But I've actually written articles on this for Mind Matters about how the next AI that comes out, I want to call it Mediocrities, because it is AI is an invitation to mediocrity. That's what it is to me. It is a statistical representation of what all the experts say, or all the people the AI programmers think are experts say. That's what it is. It people think it's magical, blah, blah, blah. It is a statistical representation of what some group of experts say. That's what it is. And that is never going to be as good as any of the experts. If you take the writing of Shakespeare and the writing of Edgar Allan Poe, both of whom are excellent, and you merge them, you're going to get mediocre writing. And so you have to be very careful about relying on these things. They may be good for prompts. They may be good for other things like that, but relying on them for text is just, it's like fingers on a chalkboard for me. I just can't, like, it's a thing. So
yeah, it's the rule of the average, right? Like, eventually everything, you know, if you get enough numbers, then you're just going to get the average. You're not even going to get the mean. You're just going to get average.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, it's interesting point that you brought up on, if it's good enough, right? Like, what is good enough? And, you know, for some things you want to just be good enough, but for others you want to be excellent. And I mean, I struggle with this. I use AI on some of these, like introductories, or, you know, not the whole book for sure, but maybe for like an email or two. And when I write a LinkedIn post, there's like, have you noticed there's like experiment with AI. With AI. And sometimes it is better. So, or it is more conforming to the norm. And I think that's the key. It's conforming to the norm. And do you want something that conforms to the norm? If that's okay for you, then great. But you know, a lot of times when you're writing a book, because your name is on the cover, you want it to be excellent. You want it to be representative of you and not the average.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think AI is perfectly fine for some things, right? Like, I don't want to have to craft animated videos as promotions for my books.
Right.
Right. Fine. Go to a video provider. Even writing summaries for chapters, feed it a chapter and then let it write a summary for you. Fine. I don't care. I don't need to handcraft my summaries. Now, there's another side of that, which is I'm giving my book to the AI to use for other people.
Right.
And that's a little disturbing sometimes, but I don't know. That's the thing. I know, Tom, you use it for coding a lot. I don't know. Well, this is just a thing for me.
I don't use it a lot. I use it to teach myself concepts. I don't.
Okay. Well, yeah. See. Yeah.
I don't tell it to write code, which I then paste into my applications.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but again,
it's a teacher.
That's a really good. That's actually a really good example, right? Suppose I wanted to write a film noir or a noir detective novel, right? I may go to an AI and say, "I'm going to write this out and give it to me in noir format." Not because I'm going to use it, but because I'm learning how to pick the style up. I'm learning what the style contains. I'm learning how to what the turn of phrase is that I need to use to make it sound that way. That to me seems like, as a training tool, it seemed for me, it seems like a perfectly legitimate use case.
Yeah, I mean, kind of going back to the apprenticeship model, if you are going to depend on another person to kind of guide your training, that's, if you're good with that model, then you should be good with learning from AI, because it's really just taking a bunch of trained masters and mashing them together, and then because ultimately you have to decide how much of the approach the master's approach you're going to take. And using AI to do that seems fine. But I think there is a great big asterisk, which is what you're saying, Eric, which is you're consuming the average. And so you have to understand that that's what it is. But we're humans. We get to make decisions. We get to decide how much of the tutoring and the teaching we accept for our own.
Yeah.
I think therefore lies the biggest problem with OpenAI and ChatGPT in general is we don't know which data they get the data from, right? So if I remember, if I remember and interpret the lawsuit with New York Times with OpenAI correctly, was that they actually openly stated that they put more emphasis on New York Times articles. So essentially, your average from ChatGPT was a average of the experts, then awesome. But if your average is the average of everybody in the world, I don't know how much I could trust that medical advice that I just typed in, right? So, right. And then that's the biggest problem with the AI is we're not at the capacity to understand their model, and they don't disclose the data that they train their models from.
Yeah. So another good use for AI, Tom, that's very similar to your mentorship or your apprenticeship, is just talk to the dummy, right?
Right. Yep.
When I was at Cisco, we had an office, and the office had a dummy in it. Literally a blow-up doll dummy sitting at a desk. That's what it was. And if you were coding something or you were struggling with something, the office door was always open. And the idea was is that there was a whiteboard and markers, and you would go explain the problem to the dummy, right? Because 80% of the time, once you've explained it to the dummy, all of a sudden you understand it yourself. In explaining it, you've had to think it through in a more rational way. And so, I mean, I know coders who keep rubber ducks on their desk. They do the same thing, right? They stick the rubber duck on the top of their monitor and say, I don't understand this ducky, and they like go nuts trying to get, you could use AI in that way as well and just treat the AI as a dummy. Say, all right, this is what I think. Where am I wrong? Right? And like, explain it to the AI and have the AI spit back and go, that was coherent. That made sense to me. Then all of a sudden, you're picking up in a more interactive way. So that seems like a possible use to me for AI. I don't want to be completely down on it, but
I'm the reverse. I say, hey, AI, I'm the dummy. Explain Pythagorean theorem to me.
No.
And that is where like 99% of people do.
Yeah.
But Russ, I think you just remind me of an interesting, concept at Amazon, right? Like, I don't know if Bezos would call them the dummy. I mean, but it's essentially at every meeting or at the important ones anyways, that you leave an empty chair, and that empty chair is the most important person in the room, who is the customer. So you're always just having that person, like that physical presence in mind. And I've also heard variation from various teams that I've been to is that, you want to give the empty chair, the customer, a persona of your ideal customer set. So in this case, like maybe your reader or the person that you're trying to reach. And in this case, that let's just say is your customer is a very cost conscious, person. So you want to call the person like Thrifty Teresa or whatever, right? Not to say Teresa is thrifty for sure, but you say, so every time you refer to Teresa, you think of Thrifty, and that reminded you of your objective. So in this case, if your persona is a network engineer, between 2 to 5 years of experience, you're trying to explain this concept to the person, then it could be, NetInj Ned or whatever, right? So then you're kind of reinforcing yourself of the idea, the persona, and craft your message accordingly, whether that's for a book, for a podcast, or for any other content.
Yeah, I think that's really good. So the only other thing on my list was stress. And I don't know how many times I've heard this, but the page is blank. And I don't know where to start. And what people do to counter this quite often is to build a very detailed outline. This is the way we're taught to write. Build a very detailed outline. Well, anybody who's ever written with me will know my outlines aren't detailed, and they are suggestions. They're like recipes. They're suggestions. The book comes out however the book comes out. Like, I don't follow the outline. Sorry.
You're kidding. Like, our preparation for this episode was so detailed. No, I'm just kidding. It's blank, right?
It's
blank I know that style. Yeah, I know that style, Russ.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my Pearson publisher once told me, he said, he emailed me, and I said, I'm going to move this chapter here and that chapter there, which means just don't edit those chapters yet. I need to write some intros and exits a little bit, you know, and some blend areas and stuff. And he wrote me back and he said, your writing has a lot of entropy in it.
That is a compliment. That is a compliment.
Yeah, exactly. Like, explain more.
Yeah. So, you know, I think we get too stressed and too scared, but there are techniques you can use to get over it. First thing, start where you want to start. You don't have to start with the introduction. If you're most comfortable explaining how BGP adjacencies form or peering sessions form, write it down. You can write the introduction later. You don't have to write the intro to the book. If you're more comfortable with pulling together little pieces and writing each little independent piece independently, write them. You can write flow into the book later or into the presentation later or whatever it is. You don't stress about that. Like that's you're better off to write your anchors first, to me, in all cases.
Yeah, I think it was just to your point, Russ, and it's Atomic Habit who mentioned that you want to strive for a system that you rely on, right? So when all the inspiration, all the motivation fails, you fall back to the system. So so I think that's a good analogy to what you talked about on whenever there's stress, you know, you just start, like your system would just start writing, right? So that's your system, and somebody else should come up with their own system or learn from you and have that same adaption of just start writing. Doesn't need to write from start to finish, doesn't need to be intro to conclusion. And so for me, my system would be to always have this arc that I have rely on. You know, maybe you start from small, start from big, and, you know, explain something. And so I have my own system, but you were going to say something as well. So maybe your next step in de-stressing the process.
That's pretty much it. And I think the other thing is that if you write consistently and you don't care if you have to throw stuff away, that de-stresses a lot as well, right? Like, people, it's got to be perfect every time I write it. No, it doesn't. I have probably thrown away millions more words than I've ever gotten published in my life. I mean, you just write stuff and well, that just wasn't good. Okay, I'll keep it in a Word document someplace or the text document or something someplace. And maybe in 5 years, I'm writing something else and I think, oh yeah, you know that thing I wrote? Hey, that might fit here, right?
I had an English professor that said something I've never forgotten. She said, "We mix creation and revision at our peril." Mm. I thought that was a good way to say it.
Yes,
some stuff's going to end up on the cutting room floor, and you just can't do it in one motion.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah,
and back to the Stephen King story, right? So I think he published 68 books, like something ginormous, right? Like, you know, 68 books, but he only wrote. Well, more than any of us, I think. A lot of us
combined.
But I could always have a dream. But but the point was, he published 68 books, but all of them are fiction. Only two of them are nonfiction, and there's only one book on writing. And we mentioned it last time. I think it's just called On Writing, I think. And so you could, you know, I would highly recommend people to go read that and just realize, even for such a established author, such a distinct, you know, like talented, you know, people say talented author, the structure that he has is just to keep on writing. And he openly admit that there's so many that is left on the cutting floor, but the point is just to keep on writing. And I think that's worth something. on, you know, just that structure and the persistence.
And when you come against deadlines, I think it's also helpful because you're writing ahead, right? Yeah. So if I've written a million words that have never been published and I come up against a deadline and I need to write a book or I need to build a course that I'm teaching for Pearson or whatever, I'm not starting from scratch almost ever. I'm always going back to what I've written in the past and using it for inspiration and source material to, you know, build on for future. And even like with The Hedge, we've said this many times, we're a month out. Like we always are a month out. We have four shows in the can recorded almost all the time. And that's just because, you know, some people get sick sometimes and have to be rescheduled and blah, blah, blah. You know, life happens and you can't be recording on Tuesday of every week to publish on Thursday of every week. That's just not, you're going to drive yourself nuts. You're going to burn yourself out doing that. It's better to have stuff in the can and be ahead of the game. That's my way of dealing with it.
I want to double click on your idea on always having something prepared and ready to go. What do you guys use for these, like note-taking? Is there any specific tools or software that you guys like? I know Mural has been, you know, like pretty popular lately for your mind map. I know, you know, people use Evernote, people use, you know, all kinds of various tools. So I'm curious to what do you guys use, or if there's such a tool that you use, maybe Tom, you could let us know first.
Sure. I've had kind of an evolution. I started out with text files, that I stored on a server somewhere and,
nice.
You know, and it was fine, but it became unmanageable as it always does. And then I think I went to Evernote after that. I'm thinking back 15, 20 years, but, and Evernote taught me how, important it is to curate, your stuff and know where it is and stuff. And then, you know, there was something with the subscription or something that made it undesirable. So I moved to something else and hopped around a little bit. You know, I've done a tour with, you know, the Make Docs and the sort of the static, website creation sort of things. And those are great. And, you know, now I have trended towards hosting my own stuff on my own infrastructure so that it's not out just because I want it to be private. So, and today I use a little blogging site type thing called Bookstack, and it's just on a private server on my private network. And I use it for keeping notes, and it's got a little WYSIWYG editor, and that's where I put my scraps.
That's kind of cool. Yeah. I mean, I hadn't thought about this before, but you could use a private wiki.
Right.
Like you can just run your own server, even if you don't run it, even if you push it onto,
WordPress or something.
Yeah.
Right?
Even if you run it on something like Amazon or, you know, Linode or something else, and you just ran a wiki on a VM, so it's not in your house, that's fine.
Yep.
You know. So I've tried a lot of different things. I tried Evernote for a long time, and I couldn't make it work. I tried mind mapping. Mind mapping doesn't work for me. I rely on OneNote, even though it's a commercial product. My life is in OneNote. I have thousands of pages of OneNote. And part of the reason it works better for me than Evernote is that Evernote feels very constrained in the number of levels of things you can get to.
That's right.
Right. There's like three, I think, or four at the most. Whereas OneNote has notebooks, sections, section groups, pages, subpages. It's like 10 or 15 levels of stuff that you can do. And I find that really useful for organizing stuff because I just deal with so much information. So I do most of my work in OneNote, although I do use Todoist as my to-do list. So that's my combination right now is OneNote and Todoist. I tried to do to-do notes or to-do in OneNote and it doesn't work very well. And I tried to store information in Todoist, and for a while, I was actually using Zotero as my notepad, believe it or not, which is kind of crazy. But it works really well, actually, especially if you are focused on websites and things that have URLs or something like that. Zotero is actually a really good way to organize information in that area. But I just found it too constrictive for other things that I wanted to do. It doesn't have the broad text fields that something like OneNote has. So, yeah.
So that's I echo back what you guys talked about on Evernote, on both the subscription model that, you know, like you know, teed off a lot of people, as well as, you know, the level of organization. I think for Evernote, so for me at least, and for all the people I've talked to, that tagging is really like the only way to organize your information. If you, because the search function, I think if you organize it into like folders and subfolders and subfolders or subfolders, then it's hard for them to search. Like they don't do a flat search, and they don't do, anyways, like I forgot what it was, but end up being tagging is the only way, which is, you know, becomes very restrictive. I tried OneNote, and I was actually forced to use OneNote because, you know, I was at Microsoft and there's no other product. So, but I eventually end up, what I rely on most right now is Notion. And what I liked about Notion is the amount of templates that they have. So besides, you know, just Evernote-ish, you know, text structure, and they could also make your blog like a node. I'm sorry, they could block like code so that, you know, it's not formatted. Like it doesn't, you know, your code doesn't become like a bunch of like smiley faces or whatever because of the weird character, right? So Notion and the large amount of templates that they have is... And by the way, there's no like affiliation for me and Notion. I'm not trying to sell the product. Is that, you know, if I start a new project, I'll actually, my default place, like financial planning for my own business. And then I was like, okay, where do I start? Like, how do I format it? And then I'll go to Notion and say financial formatting template. And they'll actually give you like a good starting point where you could like structure, here's your, you know, do your P&Ls, here's you do your balance sheets, and here's where you establish your annual goals. And, you know, then they're, most of the time they're free and sometimes they're paid, but that's one question that when people talk about idea gathering, that I'm always interested in the way that they structure it.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I'd never seen Notion, so I'll take a look at it actually. Because, I mean, I guess the big thing for me too is OneNote is that I already pay for it. It's part of Office 365, so like it doesn't cost me anything more than I'm already paying. So why not just use it? So yeah. So okay, well, we are running up against time, so we should wrap up. Okay. Anything else you want to talk about, Tom, in publishing before we?
No, it's been really great. Okay. Thanks, Eric. It's been a great chat.
Eric, what about you? Anything other topics? I think we hit all the topics we were going to talk about. And even if we didn't, it's okay. I mean, there are future Hedge episodes. Seriously. There really are.
Okay.
There will be lots of them.
So. And we can keep talking about publishing. That's totally awesome.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. I don't have any advertisers to care about, so fine.
Nice. Yeah, no, nothing else. I think I've really enjoyed every time I get to talk to you guys. You know, it's great. You know, it's always a pleasure. And, you know, there's nothing else I want to talk about, but really just kind of call to action. Just get started. Like what you said, Russ, like if you have something to talk about, if you have a opinion about something, or even if you just want to shout at the world, you don't have to do it alone. You know, why don't you do it in public so that we have some track record? And you never know, this would be a good, you know, to me, it always comes back more positive than negative, unless you're saying something like super negative, and then keep it to yourself. But but yeah, if you have an opinion about something, you're learning in public, you build in public, it always come back positively, at least for me and the people I talk to. So yeah, get started.
Yeah, get started. Awesome. Okay, Tom, where can people find you?
Can you find me on
Twitter, but I'm going to ask you anyway.
One of these days, I'm going to say something different just to throw you. I'm on LinkedIn.
And Eric, where can people follow you if they want to?
You can find me on LinkedIn as well. And I'm not really hard to find. You know, I also host a community called networkautomation.community. And that is where, you know, mostly I gather people who wants to help each other. It's a small community for now, but hopefully it would be a destination for somebody who wants to get started with network automation.
Awesome. That's great. I'll try to remember to put that in the show notes so people can just click on it, but you hear it anyway. It's network.automation. Is that it?
Networkautomation.community.
Okay. Networkautomation.community. Okay, cool.
Yeah. We have so many top level now. It's way beyond .com and .net.
I know. It's crazy. All right. So I'm Russ White. You can always find me here at The Hedge at rule11.tech on LinkedIn, sometimes on X or Twitter or whatever you want to call it nowadays. On Pearson, I don't know, wherever. You'll find me. Don't worry about it. Just look me up. You'll find me in all sorts of different places. Okay, so thanks for listening to the show all the way to the end. We know we live in an attention-based world, and it's really important that you spent time with us and really cool. So thank you for listening again, and we will catch you next time.